It is Wednesday, February 16th, 2022. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, investigative journalist Christopher Leonard, author of The Lords of Easy Money, How the Federal Reserve Broke the American Economy. Also on the program today, new NOAA report, sea levels will rise on U.S. coastlines by a foot within the next 25 years. Meanwhile, mixed reports of Russian drawdown as Putin signals for more negotiations. Joe Biden and the White House will reject Donald Trump's privilege claim of White House visitor logs. That should be interesting. Meanwhile, Senate Republicans stall a vote on Fed nominees. And with New York's Kathleen Rice's announcement, Democratic House retirements hit 30. More than any other time in the past 30 years. U.S. COVID infections drop below its September high. And mask requirements, big companies drop, including one that is a little bit more disturbing than others.
Relevant to you, perhaps?
Talk about that in a moment. CDC reports that vaccinations during pregnancy protects infants. And Sandy Hook families settle with the Remington gun manufacturer for $73 million. And lastly, Sarah Palin loses her defamation case.
We could have seen that coming.
All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Joining me, as always, on her favorite day. Emma Vigeland. Hello, Emma.
Hello. Hello.
Do you want to do your catchphrase?
It's hump day.
There you go.
It's hump day.
She coined it. Mentioned this a little bit in the headlines. Infections are way down relative to their peak just a month ago. And in this country, and deaths are still above 2,000. That is a lagging indicator, of course. Nevertheless, we have masks mandates by different companies that are beginning literally to fall.
Including here, right? I mean, now you took initiative from these other major corporations, and now you're telling us not even to wear masks outside of the studio.
No, that's not true.
Okay.
That's not true at all. We're not going to supply that type of misinformation. I woke up this morning, and as people know, I like to listen to the radio in the morning, catch what the AP news is, just to see what the normies are hearing. And first thing literally was Disney drops its mask mandates. And as of tomorrow.
It's like they knew.
Well, February vacation. That's what's going on.
Yeah.
They know that they probably, I imagine, have a lot of people coming down from the north. And so that should be interesting.
Well, it's just Disney and Marvel are both, you know, they're the same company, right? They're the same company. They heard about how much you can't stand superhero movies.
I don't think it's done
for me.
And
they're trying to spite you.
Yeah, I don't. It's possible they could be, but you know, it's. But it's going to be interesting. You know, me and my kids will wear masks inside the rides as we had planned to do, anyways. And it's just going to be interesting to see how. I'm more interested to see how other people react to it.
Right.
At that point, I'm not. You know, my feeling is. You're mostly outside anyways, and with a good mask, and you're indoors for a limited period of time that's not necessarily a closed space. You're moving around, right? You're on a ride or something like that. One-way masking probably pretty effective in those situations, but it should be interesting. Nevertheless, let's get to it. This was an interesting watch.
Mm-hmm.
Professor Jonathan Turley, he is a law professor at George Washington University. He has been around for quite some time. Back during the Bush years, he was a frequent guest, I think, on Keith Olbermann's show and other sort of left-wing shows, or anti-Bush, I guess, shows, as you'd be more accurate maybe to say for some people. And then somewhere around Obama, the Obama broke his brain. And he became kookier and right-wingier and nuttier. Sometimes that allure of becoming Alan Dershowitz becomes too strong.
Right. I mean, who wouldn't want to be him?
Now, just because you're a law professor doesn't mean that you automatically know nothing about anything. Okay? In other words, like, I can understand it if you're a law professor and you don't know anything about the basics of, let's say, medicine.
Right.
Because you're not a medical professor. You know,
yes,
like a,
yes,
or
yes,
medical professor. Is that where they go? You go to med school? Right. But I don't think being a law professor means that you don't know some of the basics about U.S. history. That doesn't seem to...
Usually there's somewhat of an overlap because the law is involved in U.S. politics and U.S. political history, certainly.
Yeah, so my assumption is that, like, Turley knows his history. And so I was shocked by what he revealed to me in this clip. He's talking about the... Canadians who are protesting, I guess, vaccinations and the existence of a government, I think, in Canada. I mean,
and NASA as well.
And NASA?
And communists.
Oh, NASA. And communists.
Throw NASA in there, too.
Probably NASA.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And they blocked the bridge. Here's Jonathan Turley expressing his outrage. Now, let me just say before we play this, I find it a little appalling, the ability for banks to freeze people's accounts. I think that's super scary. I think it's absolutely
Trudeau
wrong.
Is in the wrong.
I don't feel comfortable with people calling them terrorists because I think that word is problematic, at least in the hands of governments. But aside from that, let's hear Jonathan Turley on Fox.
What's happening here on the ground? Back to you.
Okay, thank you, Alexis. I want to get right to our Fox News contributor and George Washington law professor Jonathan Turley on this rapid expansion of Canadian government powers. Dying to know what you thought of it, Jonathan.
Pause it for a second.
Well, I thought it was
to sort of lead into that. Like, let me get sing-songy, and we're watching the Canadian government starting to freeze personal bank accounts. What do you think about
this? Starting
to
happen now.
Oh my gosh!
Watch out!
Yeah, I mean the
it's so bad.
I wonder if she has the ability to sort of like seamlessly move into and Brad and whoever the and Angela Angela Jolie. I'm just trying to think like she could do like
she's like an entertainment
Hollywood
reporter.
Gossip.
Gotcha.
Like, oh, this is pretty spicy.
I think she doesn't know the difference between like a story that's completely made up where their outrage is completely fabricated versus one where there's a kernel of truth to
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
And there's like a Ron Burgundy element too where she's reading the prompter but she just went with that kind of happier tone.
Right. Look who we've got here.
It's daytime programming.
They're executing people on the streets. What does Jonathan Turley think about that? All right, go ahead.
On this rapid expansion of Canadian government powers, dying to know what you thought of it, Jonathan. Hello.
Well, I thought it was, quite excessive. This is an act of civil disobedience. That is a standard tactic of groups going back to the civil rights movement even earlier to block bridges and streets to do what was referred to as, quote, good trouble. And so the troubling aspect of what is coming out of the prime minister's office is that by this rationale, they could have cracked down on the civil rights movement. They could have arrested Martin Luther King. I mean, I think that the office needs to dial down, not just in this rhetoric, but the means that it is using. By freezing this money, But what the government is doing is preventing other people from supporting protests. These are Canadian.
I never really contemplated the idea that this type of that a government would arrest Martin Luther King. I mean, I know that these folks are fighting for the civil rights of people who own $65,000 trucks to not have to wear a mask. Yes. But I hadn't really contemplated the idea that, can you imagine? Have they arrested Martin Luther King?
I know.
And any of the civil rights people been arrested? That would have been appalling. Bradley, how many times did Martin Luther King not get arrested? Is there any way to Google that? We can find that out. I mean, wasn't he was given like a medal of honor?
Speeding tickets.
Maybe. Speeding tickets. Okay, well, here it is. Okay. What's this? Wait.
Arrests. That's plural.
Wait, what? Scroll. Okay, it's one, two. Okay, three. Three. Four. Five. Six. Let's see. Seven. That's going to the eight. It turns out Martin Luther King was arrested 29 times.
Huh.
Yep.
Wow. I mean, but you have to be a history buff to know that.
Yeah, I mean, you'd have to. I mean, who could have ever imagined that Martin Luther King was anything other than celebrated in his day?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't know critical race theory, so I think that's part of why I was unaware.
What can you play the footage of the water cannons that were used on those people on the bridge? Oh, it doesn't. Okay. Mm. Sorry. Just do the one where they're getting beaten with batons. What about the one with the German shepherds?
Yeah.
No? Oh, all right. That's weird.
Bradley, okay. Why didn't you do your job today? You didn't get that footage.
You didn't get that footage of the Canadian F-450 owners getting clubbed to death. Or not to death. Well, in some instances.
Good use. Turley knew the good trouble phrase.
Yes.
He knew to invoke that in a disturbing and offensive way.
Yeah.
He didn't know basic history about Martin Luther King.
Get the sense that one of his third years are going to be a little bit embarrassed when they when he gets back from the studio and they say and he says, somebody told me that Martin Luther King was arrested.
Yeah, it went a little viral last night.
And, you know, we have all come out and said we don't agree with what Trudeau's the powers he's given to the banks, so we're standing up for the speech rights of our enemies here. You never really hear that the other way around, though. You never hear, like, hey, maybe it's your guys' fault this is happening because you didn't stand up for when, for instance, BDS fundraising is attacked all the time.
Right.
You never hear that lesson, because I think, like, a lot of that is mainly less about, like, getting the left to be better about free speech and more about blaming them for when the roll-up actually comes.
Well said. All right, folks. Just a reminder, you can come see this show live in Brooklyn or in Boston. Any of the two places on the East Coast with a B in their name that are bigger than, let's say, Bedford Falls.
And Baltimore.
Well, Baltimore is not really the East, Northeast.
Okay.
It's not.
Okay. It's
I know. I know. From North Dakota, it feels like it is, but it's not.
It's the DMV.
Yeah. No. I'm talking the... either New England or the tri-state area. Let's put it that way.
Okay.
Buffalo.
Shoot. Hey, actually, you know, I'm not sure Buffalo is the tri-state area. I think the tri-state area is like sort of down here.
Yeah, okay. The tri-state area is like the suburbs of New York.
Look,
question?
Forget I said any of that.
Yeah.
Just Majority Live or Majority Report Live. You can buy your tickets for Boston or Brooklyn shows. Coming up, Brooklyn is March 26th. Boston is May 15th. If you want to go to Brooklyn show, you got to do it quick. Got to be quick because it's about to sell out. And Boston, if you want any of the best seats, you got to do it quick. So there's that.
And I'll be unveiling the most based quotes from Bostonians during that.
Ooh.
I got a few already selected. So.
Well, I really get a little taste of what's going to go on. They're crazy ass.
Oh, Matt, you're preparing for that?
Well, it's
nice that
it got delayed a few months, and I had time to have an idea.
Oh,
there you go.
You go.
That's the way we're going to do this. We're going to delay all of them. until they turn it to pure gold. Also, don't forget, it is your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. We are going to be doing no fun half today because we're going to be doing some tech stuff. We're going to try and upgrade our video quality today so that we're streaming in a higher quality. And we get rid of our audio issues. So we're going to do that after we do this interview. I did this interview with Christopher Leonard, author of The Lords of Easy Money, How the Federal Reserve Broke the American Economy last night. And we'll be back to close it out in just at the end of this interview. We are back. Sam Seder on The Majority Report. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the program investigative journalist Christopher Leonard. He is the author of his latest, The Lords of Easy Money, How the Federal Reserve Broke the American Economy. Christopher, welcome back to the program. My understanding is that you, the idea to start to write this book came in the context of when you were writing Coakland, when someone had outlined for you just how much money the Fed essentially created, I think is the best way to put it, didn't exactly print it. They created in the course of a couple year span, I can't remember off the top of my head what that span was, relative to the existence of the Fed. Just tell us that figure before we go into some more remedial questions I have for you.
Yes, the headline is that in a few short years, between 2008 and 2014, the Fed printed 3.5 times as much money as it had printed in the first century of its existence. So the way I put it is it's 350 years worth of money creation in a few short years. And yes, it radically redrew our financial system and our economy. And that's what got me going on this topic.
Okay, so let's start with some very basic remedial questions, because I really think that people tend to hear stuff about the Fed, and unless they are investors, mortgage brokers, unless they're sort of like have a direct, they sort of gloss over it. So just tell us, let's just start with what is the Fed and what is their mandate? What were they set up to do?
That's great. And the remedial basic stuff is so important. And that's why I wrote this book, is to try to just communicate clearly and in English and in an easy way what this institution is and why it's so important to everybody. So the Fed is our central bank. And we created the Fed in 1913 to do two important things. The Fed, first of all, most importantly, was created to originate and manage our currency. You know, the thing we call a dollar is a Federal Reserve note. That's why we have a central bank, to have a currency. And then the second thing the Fed was supposed to do is to be on deck in case of a banking panic, to be the so-called lender of last resort, print money to lend to otherwise healthy banks and to stop financial panics. And for many decades, the Fed did these two very important jobs, but it stayed within that sort of narrow band of responsibility. And the story I'm trying to tell is what happened after 2010, when the Fed dramatically expanded its reach, the size of its interventions, and kind of it tried to become the main engine of economic growth in America by using the superpower of creating new dollars. So, you know, to your original question, the Fed is there to be the manager of our currency.
And we should say, I mean, there's two things that occurred to me. First off, we should also say it has a dual mandate in terms of like on a once you get on this, I guess the next level of functioning is to, one, control inflation, and two, although I don't want to enumerate them in this way, they theoretically are at parity, and to create employment, right? I mean, so that's that dual mandate there. Talk about that for a moment, but I just also want to put a pin in the idea of there are also two ways to respond to a crisis if you are a government or a society, and that is fiscally and monetarily. So let's start with the dual mandate of inflation and employment.
Okay. And this is really important. What you're talking about is this law that Congress passed in 1978 that gave the Fed two jobs. First, control price inflation, and second, get that unemployment rate as low as possible. Now, that's a real thing and it's mandated by law. But one thing I try to point out in the book is that the dual mandate is not a useful way to think about what the Fed is doing in the following way. These mandates come into conflict at key moments when they are most important. In other words, to control price inflation, you often have to raise interest rates, which raises unemployment. And to get unemployment as low as possible by printing money, you create inflation. And so the dual mandate is this idea, but it comes into conflict. And, we're in that sort of conflict today. So there is that broad mandate. And, you know, the Fed is thought of most times as raising or lowering interest rates. They've kind of been managing the currency in a steady way for decades. And that is what you just mentioned, monetary policy, the handling of U.S. money. But then there's this whole other thing of what our democratically controlled institutions can do, fiscal policy. That's building roads, building bridges, funding research. That's what's supposed to drive economic growth, frankly. But over the last 10 years, our fiscal institutions, our democratic institutions have really been paralyzed and characterized by dysfunction. And that's why the Fed has stepped in and said, okay, well, we will drive growth through monetary policy. And I think the record shows pretty clearly that these programs of trying to drive growth by creating unprecedented amounts of new dollars in the banking system really isn't a great formula. It benefits the very, very rich, and it makes our financial system more fragile.
Okay, and I'm going to, as we get a little further into this, I'm going to press you on the inflation, because I'm maybe a little heterodox in the inflation perspective. But one thing that I think is absolutely clear is the mechanisms that the Fed has pursued, and I would argue even in the CARES Act as well, have accelerated the wealth inequality in this country and have concentrated the money in fewer and fewer hands in this country. And that is really, I think, what this story is all about. So let's go back. And I just want to reiterate, too, that part that you said about the fiscal thing. We have not had a Congress, essentially, that is prepared to deal with recessions, Great Recession, in a way that sort of economics has been broadly accepted, you know, a Keynesian reaction to when you have a slowdown in your economy or some type of crisis, you spend your way out of it. We haven't been able to do that because we've had a Congress that's been reluctant to do that for the most part, at least, when we had the 2008 crisis and the monetary policy sort of had to supplant the actual expenditure of dollars by spending it, by creating it. So let's go back to 2008. We have a financial crisis, and just tell us the situation we were in. And I have a thesis about everything that follows from that I'd like to bounce off you. And this is, walk us through this, because one of the things that I've noticed over the years is that people who are involved in finance think that no one else can really understand it. And that if you say, like, hey, this might be a problem, people just, they'll pat you on the head. Like, Literally, I was in an office pretty close to a corner office at Bear Stearns just by sheer coincidence, almost the only time I've ever been in it. Days before they shuttered the place, saying, hey man, should I be grabbing some of your swag here? Because I'm reading stuff on blogs, and I just was reading the right people. Like, I'm hearing bad stuff about it. They're like, no, I just had these guys around the corner okay me buying the debt of, I can't remember, like of some Central American country, and they would have never okayed that if we were in trouble. And 5 days later, he was literally they had locked him out of his office.
And to that point, I think about 6 months prior to that time, or a little bit longer than that, 8 months, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, Ben Bernanke, had gone up in front of Congress and said, hey, we're seeing some volatility, but the problems in the subprime mortgage sector will be contained. Don't worry. And you're absolutely right that these authorities speak about what they do with needless complexity, and they try to portray it as rocket science that only a PhD could understand, but it's not that way at all. It's sure, it takes some time to kind of get up to speed on the mechanics of how it works and what it does, but it's not rocket science. And so let's talk about what happened, but let's never forget your headline. These policies were probably more significant than any other in driving the wedge even deeper between the very richest Americans and everybody else. This stuff was an enormous boom to income inequality. And that's not like an analysis. That's just mechanically how this works. Let me explain it. In the shadow of 2008, you're exactly right. Our democratic institutions, whether you're conservative, liberal, whatever you think, we can agree, they did not get in there and fix the fundamental problems that led to that economic calamity of 08. So in the shadow of that, this book actually starts on November 2nd and November 3rd, 2010, when the Tea Party comes into Congress, you know, furthering the dysfunction, shutting down Congress. That's when the Federal Reserve embarks on this experimental path. And over the next, you know, 5 to 7 years, the Fed did two very important things. They kept the interest rate at zero for 7 years, which is a historical anomaly. Nothing like that had ever been done. So that means you can't earn any interest on money, and interest rates are historically low. But then they did the key important thing here. The Fed did this thing they call quantitative easing, back to your point about trying to make everything sound hyper complicated. What this is new money creation on Wall Street. The Fed can only create new dollars in one way. It can't create them in your checking account or my checking account. The Fed creates new dollars inside the bank accounts of 24 select institutions on Wall Street called primary dealers. And between 08 and 2015, the Fed created trillions of new dollars by basically buying things from these primary dealers, from JP Morgan, Goldman Sachs. The Fed would buy a treasury bond and say, hey, look in your bank account at the Fed. Poof, you know, $8 billion just appeared to fund that transaction. The Fed did this over and over again until it had printed multiple trillion dollars, you know, about $3 trillion over a few years in the Wall Street banking system. That's the key. It wasn't Keynesian in the sense that the Fed wasn't out there hiring people to pick up shovels and dig ditches like we did in the New Deal. The Fed wasn't building the Hoover Dam. It was overfilling the bank accounts on Wall Street with the express goal of making debt cheaper and forcing banks to basically make riskier and riskier loans, search out on the yield curve, as they say, to stimulate growth.
Okay.
I want to
go through the mechanics of that, but I just want to back up just a little bit here too, because in the mechanics of that, like in 2008, we had a situation where, and we had had, and in many respects, the Fed kept their rates low, building up the basically creating this bubble in the real estate market, because when the rates are low, and people should understand this, people who have money are looking to get the highest return they can. If they go into things and the rates are low, they're looking for other things to get a return on, and it ended up juicing the real estate market. And then you had all these side bets that were built upon the real estate market as these things were securitized. So you have these huge bags essentially of loans, many of which were really bad loans that bankers made without doing their due diligence. Their loan officers, and presumably because they have a fiduciary responsibility to make sure these loans are good, and they didn't do that. When the Fed first addressed this problem in 2008, when there was an emergency, right? And the Fed came in and bought a lot of these bad loans. There was a decision that was made, and this is from what I'm not directly quoting Barney Frank, but this is what he said, that when Obama had won the election, George W. Bush is the president, Paulson basically said, we have basically two choices. we either buy these bad loans from the banks so that the banks don't go under, or we reduce the principal or the basically the size of the loan at the lenders so they can pay the banks and the banks are still made whole, but it goes through the borrowers, so they're made whole too. And that decision, Paulson said, I can't do that without Obama to sign off on this because he's going to be the new president. Barney Frank says he went to Paulson. Paulson said this to him. He went to Obama. Obama said, we only have one president at a time. Obama never signed off on it. The rest is history. They ended up basically bailing out the banks instead of bailing out the banks by bailing out the homeowners, right? I mean, this is where we were leading into 2010. And the Tea Party comes in, but also the Obama administration turns to austerity at this point, which means there is going to be no spending. And yet we still have this problem. When the Fed starts to do QE1, quantitative easing one, the first round, what do they get in return when they put these dollars on the ledger of these 24 banks?
Okay, so much to unpack here. And if I could please point out, you accurately described the response to the crash of 08, and the dynamics you just described go really across the board. That is very different, I must point out, than what happened in 1933 after the crash and the banking crisis of the 20s. The government of FDR and the Democrats stepped in and they took over the banks. They broke up the big banks. They put Wall Street on a leash. That's a structural response. What we did in 08 was totally different. We bailed them out. We flooded the system with more money to simply stop the chaos. And then when the dust cleared, we did not go in and break up the too big to fail banks. We did not go in and impose serious structural changes. We did a bunch of rules through Dodd-Frank. So this is a perfect way to get us to 2010. And this highlights what is at the core of this. Yes, the Fed acted. And yes, Congress was paralyzed and dysfunctional. But we need to look at your question, what did the Fed get in return? Or maybe the way I'd put it is, what were the implications of these policies? What the Fed was talking about doing was, again, encouraging even more risky lending after the housing bubble, okay, by keeping interest rates at zero. They say we're going to have another decade of very low interest rates, and then we're going to pump this cash into Wall Street to supercharge it. And the Fed knew at the time that one of the key effects of this was going to be it was going to drive up asset prices, meaning driving up the price of stocks, corporate bonds. It was going to sort of supercharge these markets. And the hope was this creates what they call the, quote, wealth effect, that when stock prices break records, when the corporate bond market is on fire, it creates the secondary wealth effect where people feel like they have more money in their pocket, they have more money in their 401k, and they go out and spend it. Or these companies that are getting these leveraged loans hire people on and build a factory. In fact, no news to you, this leveraged loan market and corporate debt market, it really just fueled private equity firms. It did buyout after buyout, mergers, acquisitions, stock buybacks.
How is the wealth effect really any different than the concept of trickle-down economics?
It's different in that it's more extreme. I call it hyper trickle-down economics. And this is one of the things I would really love that we could just debate publicly. You know, I had the luxury while reporting this of going back and reading the internal debates inside the Fed, interviewing Bernanke, Powell, Yellen, the governors who made these decisions. And they are saying clear as day inside the meetings that they're going to drive growth through the wealth effect. This isn't me imposing it. This is what they said. This is how they thought the plan would work. And what you see is that, again, listen, their program was driving up asset prices. The wealthiest 1% of Americans own roughly 30% of all the assets in the country. The top 10% of Americans own 65% of all the assets. This is a economic growth policy that benefits the very richest while everybody else is essentially treading water out there in the real economy.
And this again is going to sound a little remedial, but when we say asset, what is the difference between an asset, like when we talk about asset inflation as opposed to regular inflation, maybe, I guess, commodity is inflation. I mean, commodities can be an asset, I guess, if it's securitized in some way. But will you explain like what we mean by asset. Like, because they knew they were coming in and they were going to do asset inflation. They literally shut off the avenues by, and maybe you can talk about this too, but shut off the avenues to where you would invest safely. Like, there were safe investments that existed as part of that they basically foreclosed as part of this because they were going to flood the system with money from the top, but it was like a pachinko type of thing. And they narrowed where this money could end up flowing into, and it was into specific assets. But just explain, just define those terms for us.
Totally. And if I could emphasize, these are not rudimentary, elementary questions. These are like fundamental. And this is what's so important about this topic is to ask these questions. Okay, assets and prices. This is really important. You know, the last time we had runaway inflation in America was the 70s. It's remembered as the Great Inflation. And everybody looks at the so-called price inflation when food prices, car prices, energy goes up. That's price inflation. But then you've got assets. And I think the best way to describe an asset is it's anything you can buy that holds its value. You don't consume it. A house is an asset. A painting is an asset. A share of stock is an asset. During the great inflation of the 70s, asset prices became wildly inflated as well. The chairman of the Fed, Paul Volcker, who basically killed inflation by raising rates, he talked about asset inflation and price inflation as being, quote, unruly cousins. They're interlinked. And when you keep money too easy for too long, the analogy they use is it's too many dollars chasing too few goods. That's what drives up the price, all these dollars. And these dollars chase assets as well. What's so interesting is there's been this policy decision inside the Fed over the past few decades under Greenspan and beyond that the Fed was going to focus on price inflation. Okay, it was going to worry when prices started to rise, but it was going to let asset inflation run away. And the theory here is if you try to stop asset inflation, you might be hurting Wall Street prices. You might be stopping an economic boom. But this is so important because over the last decade in America, we really never saw price inflation from 2010 until today, right? And so there wasn't any, quote, inflation. Asset inflation was running away, double-digit growth each year, stocks, bonds, commercial real estate. Today, the housing market growing by 18% year over year. The Fed knew it was stoking asset bubbles, but when asset inflation happens, we call it a boom. And again, the point you're making is exactly right, that by keeping that interest rate at zero, the Fed was closing off the ability to safely save money. Okay, it was saying you really can't stash money in a treasury bill anymore. We're going to close that down and pump all this cash in to create this search for yield. And that created massive asset inflation. And the point of that is that we're in this position today. That's what I talk about when I say our financial markets are so fragile. This is the Fed debates are replete with these warnings. Folks, we're creating asset bubbles on Wall Street. They're going to explode and we can't keep pumping this money in, but they kept doing it anyway.
Is it the case that asset inflation versus price inflation or, consumer good inflation, goods inflation, asset inflation does not necessarily reach wages because it is basically just wealthy people having their investments, their speculative investments increase in value. But it's almost like there's like two economies that are functioning here. One is the economy that 80% of us live in. And the other is this other economy. I feel like what we see with crypto and like the crypto just seems to function to rise and fall based upon stuff that has really very little to do with outside of that arena, except for the fact that maybe there's times where people have more money. And so they're going to look like I can go to the races today and I'm going to buy crypto. But aside from that, what happens in crypto doesn't seem to implicate what happens in the real economy where the rest of us live. And what happens in that economy doesn't necessarily implicate crypto because unless it's like somebody needs to cash out their money in some way. And so, all right, so we're in 2010, QE, talk about the mechanisms in which this all sort of, I guess, like, where that money ended up going, because it ended up creating, like, they were in such search of new assets that you started to create these new financial instruments, and talk about that aspect of it, corporate debt and this sort of development of zombie companies.
Absolutely. And this drives exactly the point you're making of these two economies: Wall Street, hyper-speculation, asset prices breaking records. And then, you know, take any metric you want about the people in America who earn a living through paychecks, you know, wage earners, people who don't own assets. Wages have been stagnant for decades in America. The price of living has been increasing. The complexity of dealing with health insurance and all the rest of it has been increasing. Our jobs are more precarious. So these are two different worlds. And I try to show how they're really kind of colliding in this way through the Fed programs of the last decade.
So we should also add, as you go into this, we should say that as all the things that you're about to talk about are happening in the rest of the economy, jobs growth is, I mean, it's not completely gone, but it's anemic over the course of, like, this, you know, people are making huge monies in this asset sort of universe. And in the universe where people are working, their wages are not going up, and we're not getting people are still out of work years after this.
Absolutely. And that's the picture of trying to drive an economy through printing money or monetary policy. I call it, the Wall Street folks call it ZERP, zero interest rate policy combined with this quantitative easing. The era of ZERP was defined by weak economic growth, weak productivity growth, weak wage growth, and simply skyrocketing asset prices. That's just a fact. That's what 2010 to 2020 were like. So in 2010, the Fed executes these policies through its very large bank in New York. I toured this trading floor where they make these trades. And so a Federal Reserve trader calls up JP Morgan and says, hey, I want to buy $8 billion in bonds. The transaction is executed and JP Morgan opens up their account. Boom, there's $8 billion new dollars. So the Fed is flooding the Wall Street bank accounts with new cash. It's holding the interest rates down at zero, and that creates the so-called search for yield, meaning I can't save money. We've got all this cash. We got to do something with it. So I interviewed this guy who really laid it out well. His name is Robert Hetu. He's a senior vice president at Credit Suisse. And during this period, he's selling corporate junk debt, leveraged loans. And that used to be this kind of niche market where, you know, more sophisticated investors who had a bigger risk appetite, they would buy these kinds of products like leveraged loans. But during this era, you had what used to be conservative money. I'm talking like pension funds, like state pension funds, who can't earn anything by saving anymore. They're going up to Wall Street saying, okay, well, we need yield somehow. We're not getting it from saving. And they start buying these leveraged loans, which this will sound familiar. Credit Suisse would package the leveraged loans into these securitized collateralized loan obligations, CLOs. They're just like the CDOs of the housing boom. And they were selling these to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars worth a year. This guy Hetu, echoing others, told me they couldn't keep up with demand. And what's so interesting is there was such demand of this cash looking for a place to earn yield that the so-called investors who were buying it just accepted riskier and riskier and riskier terms each year. It's just like the housing market. And I profile in the book what life was like at one of these companies that actually sold the corporate junk debt, right? And it's a pretty bleak picture of these factory workers who aren't getting wages and in fact lost their jobs as the company was packaging and selling this debt and making so much money off selling this debt on Wall Street.
Okay. So, and this is where John Feltner comes in, and you have two, your main protagonist was the former president of the Kansas City Federal Reserve, who from the beginning said this could be very problematic. And I want to get into him in a moment, but I just want to sort of like make a distinction between two things. One is when interest rates are at zero, people are running around looking like, okay, I'm CalPERS, the California pension fund, and I need to get a return because my business model, if you will, is that I'm going to invest fairly conservatively because these are people's pensions, but it needs to grow. And I've got, you know, I've got people putting in money when they're 25 working in California. And by the time they're 65, this money has to grow so that I can meet my pension obligations to them. So I need a return. But with the interest rates at zero, I can't put it into a safe, you know, like the equivalent of like my bank account or a treasury bond. I can't put it in there and get 4 or 5% return guaranteed without risking it. So I've got to find these things. So and there are salesmen out there who are investment bankers who know like CalPERS is looking for something to invest in. I've got to basically create something or, you know, maximize something to sell it to them and say like 4 or 5%, you know, you can get 7 or 8% returns on this and you really don't have anywhere else to go to even get 4 or 5%. So you might as well do this, even though it's riskier. And CalPERS is like, we have no choice. We have to grow this money. How is that? I understand that dynamic. But the bonds, I think you said J.P. Morgan sold, you know, the Fed goes to J.P. Morgan and says, we want to give you $8 billion. We want to buy $8 billion of bonds. What are those bonds? What are the bonds that J.P. Morgan is selling to the Fed? Where did those come from? We just have $8 billion worth of bonds lying around? Or what was that they sold to the Fed, that the Fed theoretically got? And where does that $8 billion go?
Well, great questions all. So first of all, specifically, the bonds that were sold were two kinds. One, United States government debt, the so-called treasury bond, okay? And the second was mortgage bonds, you know, created from new home loans. And this all started during the emergency conditions of 08-09 when the Fed was like, oh my God, the house is on fire. We're going to buy mortgage bonds to stabilize the market. And then it was after that in the 2010s where the Fed said, oh, well, that worked well. Let's keep buying mortgage bonds to keep injecting cash into Wall Street and keep pumping up the housing market and real estate market. The key is that most of the bonds the Fed is buying are these treasury bonds. And that is a pretty striking large scale thing we could talk about for a long time. There are a couple key elements to it. You use the term kind of checking account but U.S. Treasury bonds, I call them Wall Street's savings account. That used to be the safe haven where you could earn 4 to 5% on a 10-year treasury bond. And that was kind of your safety net. So anyone coming in the front door had to have something that beat that, you know, guaranteed 5%. The Fed was very specific in buying that kind of bond to draw down that interest rate, to suck that savings account away, so that now I'm earning, you know, 1% on a 10-year treasury bond. So anyone who comes into my office looking for me to invest only has to make a marginally better argument than I'll earn you 1%. Listen, I also don't want to digress too much, but this has a very key further impact in that the United States government is issuing debt. The Federal Reserve is buying it through the banks and then stashing that debt inside the Fed. And a good way to measure that is when that money is stashed inside the Fed, it's on the so-called balance sheet, or it's reflected in how many assets the Fed owns. The balance sheet of the Fed, which reflected how much of these bonds it owns, the balance sheet was $900 billion back in 08. $900 billion, almost a trillion. It is now $9 trillion. And I can't overstate what an enormous step change that is. We're living in a new world, and that reflects all of these bonds the Fed has pulled onto its balance sheet, which reflects the amount of cash it's pumping in. Where did that new cash go? It went into risky assets. Of all people, McKinsey Global Institute did this like amazing study of trying to trace where the cash went. It went into risky corporate junk debt. It went into risky bonds in emerging markets. I don't know if you heard about that big Chinese real estate firm Evergrande that went south. The money flowed into those bonds because it was searching for yield. Sovereign government debt in Turkey, Argentina, essentially it went into higher risk assets is where that cash went. And, it, you know, you mentioned zombie companies. That's what happened in the United States is you had these firms issuing leveraged loans and people were buying it because there was kind of no other option. And these companies were paying more money in interest than they were earning in profits, which is what the definition of a zombie is. And the proliferation of companies like that has just exploded over the last decade. So,
and did you talk about that with in terms of John Felter, right? I mean, this is the story of now, so explain to me that dynamic. So so this is a company that really, you know, whatever, it doesn't matter really what it produces at any point. It's taken over by hedge funders. They buy the company. They buy the company by sort of like pre-issuing a pre-loan that they get to buy the company, right? I mean, they put on they put this on the balance sheet, and I mean, it's just so hard to for someone who doesn't, you know, live in that world to understand how you can do that. Like, I'm gonna go. I mean, I guess I take, you know, I guess when I get a mortgage on a house, I'm taking a loan on the value of that house, even though I don't own it yet. And then I will own it and then I'm paying off the loan. But in this instance, like the bank's not going to give me a loan for more than the value of the house, because if I can't pay off the loan, they're sort of out of luck. But it doesn't work that way with these companies.
It's amazing. Imagine it's okay. It's like if you could borrow money to buy a house, but you don't have to live in the house. And here's what's key. The house itself will generate cash every year that will pay down the loan. So you're good. And this is the basic formula of private equity. You arrange a bank loan, a leveraged loan, corporate debt. So I'm a private equity guy. I just arrange a loan and I use it for my company to purchase, in the case of what we're talking about, an old line industrial manufacturer in Milwaukee called Rexnord. So I get this leveraged loan. I use it to buy Rexnord, but I don't carry the loan. The company itself carries the loan. So now Rexnord has a ton of debt on top of it, and that firm has to use its money, its revenue every year to pay down that loan. So I'm really just kind of like the person who syndicated the debt, and I sit on top of the deal and watch. And the basic thing is you load a company with debt, and then you earn money by making that company pay the debt and slash its costs. This is why we see the, you know, get rid of the pension, shift the jobs offshore, do anything you can to streamline production and cut costs so it pays off more of the loan and then you sell it. That's the basic private equity model. The Fed's policies over the last decade supercharged this model by making that debt so cheap. And listen, this is really fascinating to me. This company, Rexnord, was purchased by a private equity firm. And the partner on top of that deal who initiated it was named Jay Powell, the current chairman of the Federal Reserve, the richest Fed chairman in history by all accounts. And he got so rich because he was a private equity deal maker his whole career. And so he bought this company, Rexnord, loaded it down with debt, sold it to another private equity firm and earned something in the ballpark of $900 million in total on that deal. That didn't all go to Jay Powell, but it went to Carlyle Group, his company, to pay off the debt. But what's key to me is that after Jay Powell, you know, syndicated the loans, bought the company, sold the company, that firm itself had to pay more money in interest rates than it earned in profit for a decade. This company was hobbled by the debt. And I kind of followed it over the next 10 years as it worked through that debt, but also loaded on more and more because, you know, the Fed was making the debt cheaper and you had these Wall Street salesmen offering to package and resell the junk debt. And, you know, eventually the owners of this company, Rexnord, ended up closing down factories in the United States, shifting the workforce to cheaper labor markets in Mexico. And, you know, the main character who worked there, John Feltner, is out of a job. And
just to be clear here,
very little.
Okay. So when we say hedge funders make the money, like it sounds like what they're doing is they're taking fees for all of these processes, right? I mean, that's basically what it is. Like, they're not making any profit off it as much as, like, because the company's not profitable at that point, right? It's having to service its debt. It's just basically treading water. But part of that treading water is that these hedge funders come in and take fees all the time, right? I mean, they're taking office supplies out. It just happens to be in cash.
It's a little bit more, you do get the fees, and those are key. And then the bankers who arrange and sell the junk loans, they get fees. And you know, Wall Street fees hit a record high in 2019. It's no surprise. Everybody knows that the fees are astronomical. But they do also earn money by owning the thing. And again, you put the debt on this company. All right. So now the company has a ton of debt, but you make the company pay off the debt. But here's what's critical. As it's paying off the debt load is decreasing and your ownership share is necessarily increasing. So that company is paying for you to own more and more of the company as it beats down the debt load. And the key is you flip it and sell it. It's like buying a used house. You maybe put in some granite countertops, you slap new paint on it, you flip it. And because the company's been paying down the debt for so many years, you get this huge chunk of money out of it through ownership, through the equity price. That's why, you know, Jay Powell's employer, the Carlyle Group, made so much money by indebting this company and flipping it after a few years, is because they got the ownership value out of it. And so it's more than the fees. It's good money.
In the meantime, they also have to diminish their labor costs, and maybe the product quality diminishes, and investment in capital. They don't, you know, they're not buying new. You may be putting new countertops on it, but you're not actually replacing the dishwasher. You're not, you're basically just stringing out all the value there so that it becomes a little bit, more precarious. But the next person who buys it, aren't they aware of it? I mean, how do they feel like they're going to make money out of it?
Well, the next person who bought it after Jay Powell owned it was a very large private equity firm called Apollo Group. And you just see how over the years, the way they make money, again, when you can borrow and lump it onto the firm, you're in a great position. So one key strategy is to use the firm you own to buy other companies. You do mergers through what you own through more borrowed money. So that's what they did with this company, Rexnord. It bought competitors. And so they would merge that onto the whole with more debt, cut costs, and keep going. And really what you're trying to do is hit that flip. You're trying to sell it. So you could see how Apollo would try to do these initial public offerings where they would sell chunks of the company on public markets, on the stock market, and then they get the cash from that sale. And that's one way they make money. So there are multiple avenues. And I'm telling you, you and I think it would be a crazy business model if I ran a lemonade stand and was just running up credit card debt all day on it, that I have to pay at the end of the day. It would be a bad business model. But that's not how it works in private equity. Again, because the companies own the debt, you have the equity stake that you can sell at the right time, and you're not as liable. I mean, if the company goes into bankruptcy, that company goes into bankruptcy. And there are lots of ways to shield your liability on that.
I think we saw that with, was it KB Toys? Happened. Okay. So where are we today? Because it feels like we had no, you know, I remember in 2010 or 11, I was doing a regular guest spot on Dylan Radigan's show, and David Stockman, who was Ronald Reagan's, I think it was budget director, if I remember correctly, came in one day and was like, "We're about to have hyperinflation. PIMCO has started to sell off, I think, treasury bonds. I think, you know, if that's what he was," and he was like, I think it might have been like April, and he's like, "By July, we're going to have, I don't know, 30% inflation." And there were people who were taking him seriously, and everybody I was reading was going like, "Man, that guy's like literally a little bit off his rocker." We never had the inflation, and it's like, because it all went into almost like not quite the savings bank, but into this other sort of world where assets are just, we're creating an ever expanding universe of assets where this money can go in and sort of operate on itself. And so little of it ended up hitting real people that we didn't have inflation. We have the CARES Act that brings up the CARES Act, and essentially the CARES Act allowed for the Fed through the Treasury to put more money into corporate America, essentially, and provide more loans, right? And it had the same dynamic where it's just some of the CARES Act, I think, definitely helped a lot of people, but it created the dynamic. It was as if like some people are driving under the yellow flag and other people are not. And they're just getting, they're starting to lap people, right? In terms of like wealth inequality. What else can you tell us about where we were at entering into COVID, what the CARES Act did, and then we'll talk about where we are now.
Absolutely. So where we were entering COVID was a decade of economic stagnation for the working class and wage earners in America, just pretty much full stop, very weak wage growth, increasing volatility in the job market, et cetera. Bad for working America. Stock prices, very, very high. And again, we never saw price inflation. Fascinating point. And most of the people who were critics of the Fed were talking about price inflation and hyperinflation. They're proven wrong. You know, the guy I profiled was making a very different argument about enriching the rich and the big banks. Tom Honig was talking about that. So that's where we were in 2019, was an era where we never saw price inflation, but we saw almost runaway asset inflation. You know, the S&P, the stock market index, had doubled in value over the decade. Go down the list. Corporate debt was at record levels. Then COVID hits and the bill really comes due. It's so fascinating. COVID was a unprecedented, not even just a once in a century shock, but unprecedented to have such an interconnected global system shut down so quickly and then try to restart. We've never seen something like it. But these elevated asset prices, the fragility of the stock market that the Fed had created, made the crisis so much worse. And so you've got, to our point about fiscal and monetary, you really had two massive bailouts that happened in the COVID shock. The first was the Fed, you know, printed 300 years worth of money in a few months in 2020, printed $3 trillion basically between February and June, I think it is. Stock markets regained all of their lost value in a matter of months. Corporate bond markets were made whole within a few months. And then you've got the real economy, which interestingly, for the first time, we do see the fiscal authorities step in and send checks to people, support actual vaccine research and production subsidies. I mean, that's real fiscal action. It had a big effect. And, you know, I think in my opinion, it's actually quite long overdue. One problem with that is that I describe it as, you know, the money used the plumbing that was there. In other words, the money that was trying to get to small businesses had to go through a very dilapidated, degraded small business administration, right? You're nodding your head. It was very...
Because it was a total absence of plumbing. I mean, we were sending money to places that we had not sent before, which was to actually support small business and people. And so there was no mechanism. There was no equivalent to the ability for the Fed to go overnight, like say, hey, we just put $8 billion in your bank account. There was nothing to do that for unemployed people, for small business owners. There was no mechanism.
That was brought into stark relief. There was no mechanism. There was no plumbing there. And I would like to point out that the bailout system for hedge funds, and this sounds like such a cliche, but it's really true. Hedge funds, private equity firms, the biggest of the institutional stock owners, the system to get money to them was like brilliant, high-speed train, perfectly maintained, instantaneous, super effective. They were fine. And the real sad fact is when you look at the metrics, there was a great study that just came out that was in reported in the New York Times. Something like 70% of the Paycheck Protection Act money went to very large businesses that didn't even keep jobs. It was like, it says the Cheesecake Factory got millions of dollars in these PPP loans and they still laid people off. Whereas, you know, your electrician down the corner struggled to work the bureaucracy and get the check they needed. It was very inefficient. To me, unfortunately, a feature of that whole time period is that we expended this unprecedented level of resources, and most of it did not go to, you know, wage earners or the lower middle classes of America.
I mean, and that was frankly the same dynamic with the bailouts in 2008. Again, we could have done what we did during FDR's time. We could have bailed out the homeowners to have them bail out the banks, as opposed to like bailing out the banks and saying, please, if you get around to it, cut everybody else some slack, which, of course, they weren't going to do on their own. All right. So we have that situation where, as inefficient as the CARES Act was, and it still helps out your average person, but it does create this tremendous amount more wealth inequality. And now we're getting inflation, this is where I think like I have some pushback.
Okay,
our inflation in this country is definitely more than we're seeing, let's say, in England or in Europe. But it's not, and it may be even like 60% more. I think in England they're going like 4 or 5% inflation. We're at like 7% inflation. Is that really a function of? Is that a function of there being too much money chasing productive capacity, or is it that we have? Not necessarily too much money, but because of the nature of all our offshoring, because of the nature of the way that our economy is structured, that logistics and other challenges are impacting us just slightly more. I mean, because other countries did not do what we did in terms of like flooding, all this cash, but they're still dealing with inflation as well. And I suspect that in many respects, like our supply lines, our logistics, our, you know, the way that we have our monopolies are inhibiting our ability to adjust to like real world shocks that are taking place.
Yes. Okay. And listen, I'm not trying to dodge the question. I think it was both. And please let me explain. I think it was a collision. Without question, the supply chain is the driver in the sense that we have never seen anything like COVID, which required us to shut down and then restart, to use a cliche, like the global supply chain. Interestingly, a couple of years ago, the prestigious Brookings Institution held a day-long event to talk about inflation and why we had not seen price inflation for the previous decade. There's no one knows. It was a great mystery. We feel like we should have seen more price inflation. The supply chain shock of 2020, to me, bolsters the argument that one reason we didn't see price inflation were because of these big global deflationary systems we built of cheap labor, cheap goods that held the price down. And then when the system came to a shuddering halt, the prices skyrocketed. So, I mean, I think you're also very correct to point out the monopolies. We have a very consolidated system for our meat in particular, for example, and those companies have the ability to raise prices very quickly. So this is all part of it. I would call that writ large, like the supply chain. You've got the barges building up on shore. You've got the monopolies jacking up prices. That supply, I do think it's very reasonable to say, and I think it's accurate, that demand played a role too. We had to send money to people in the sense of we're telling people to stay home and not go to work, and you can't have like 50% unemployment. But that money that went out to households was searching for stuff to buy. And it was searching for things to buy in a different way. We quit going out to movies and we started buying furniture, is the cliche. So in my opinion, it seems reasonable. These two things collided to create this hot inflation. Of course, it was the supply chain for sure in our existing economy. But that kind of came up against strong demand, like surprisingly strong demand of all this cash in people's hands. And that leads us to where we are.
Do we have like a mirror image of the problem in terms of like we didn't have a government that was willing to exercise any type of like fiscal response to these crises? So we relied on monetary and on some level to the extent that we have both wealth inequality and to the extent that there's too much demand, we don't have a government that is capable of raising taxes. I mean, we had a big tax cut during the Trump era. And if you wanted to inhibit demand a little bit, you could roll back some of those tax cuts, it seems to me, particularly on the high end, if you're worried about, inflationary pressures. But we don't have, again, our government doesn't have the will to do that. So we're now having to rely on a monetary response to something that, again, is like ends up being like putting 90%, 80% of the country in the target, in the crosshairs, as opposed to, you know, those people with all the cash that they have that they got in the first place, because now they're just going to have, you know, more places to invest their cash.
One consistent theme I think is important is the inability of our government, and I'm talking about like the democratically controlled institutions, Congress and the White House, to confront very powerful interests, which sounds like such a like old cliche thing to say, but after the crash of the 1920s, the government took over the bad banks, nationalized them, got rid of the bad debt, broke up the banking system through the Glass-Steagall Act so that you had speculative investment banks, but then you had commercial banks backed by a safety net. But breaking up the banks in that way was confronting very powerful, rich bankers. For some reason, we were able to do it in the 30s, but we cannot do it now. And that's one of these key pinch points that is a problem. We have not been able to confront the power and size of monopolies. For a decade in America, there's been talk about needing to have more competition and antitrust reform. In terms of the banking system, you know, the main character in the book, Tom Honig, he argued against these Fed policies, but then he came back to town in Washington, D.C. in 2012 as a bank regulator, vice chairman of the FDIC. And he came to town with a plan to break up the big banks, and to be kind of glib, he was laughed out of town. I mean, this is a conservative guy talking about the need to break up the banks to, you know, foster more competition, more regional banks, and to like put us in a position where we don't have to bail out these institutions constantly. So, you know, to your bigger point of how come it seems like the only thing we can do is print $5 trillion more dollars on Wall Street to try to solve these problems? It's because the powerful interests, they win every time. I mean, these are the folks that win, the private equity firms, the hedge funds, and the biggest of the big banks. I think that that's a real key to this continuing dysfunction.
This is like one of those heads I win, tails you lose type of situations for the vast majority of Americans. Christopher Leonard, the book is The Lords of Easy Money, How the Federal Reserve Broke the American Economy. Thanks so much for your time today. We'll put a link to that book at majority.fm.
Thank you for the time.
Okay, folks, that's going to be it.
What?
That's going to be it for
that's
us.
That's going to be lit.
That's going to be it for us today. No fun half. Apologies in advance or appropriately now, I guess.
Jesus.
I'm a little thrown off because I'm not going to say who, but my sister said, did you know that blankety blank just had a baby? And I was like, no, I had absolutely no idea. I didn't even realize she was pregnant. And I immediately texted her and said, congratulations. And she's like, okay. I was like, on the baby. And she's like, what? No, my friend had a baby. And that's why it was all over, apparently the pictures of her.
holding the baby. So I'm a little thrown off. Folks, Emma will be back tomorrow. I will be here Friday. Matt, what's happening in the Matt Lekian media universe in the meantime?
Oh, tonight, Jason and Pascal from This Is Revolution talking about a lot of stuff, maybe some trucker protest. Jason's got a new thing on Bill Cosby, and I'm going to ask them if they could have puppet master like control over, say, Hollywood. What would it actually mean? Let's get to the limits of like culture and what we could do if we actually controlled it. Tonight, 8 Eastern, patreon.com/leftreckoning.
Dude, make sure you tell them about this whole thing about MLK. Having been arrested.
Yeah.
He's a recidivist.
Yeah. Unbelievable. That's, whoa. All right, folks. We will see you tomorrow.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm going to get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught. The truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in. And my pilot light's shining bright. I guess somewhere the choice is made. For the option where you don't get paid. For the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive. Between the 101 and the 5. Do you know how far the detour takes you?